Good afternoon and welcome to all of you. Thank you for joining the Iowa City Foreign Relations Council's program featuring our esteemed guests, Dr. Adam Goodman from the University of Illinois, Chicago, and Dr. Lina Maria Murillo from the University of Texas, Austin. My name is Ted Powers, and I'm an ICFRC board member and your host for today's program. As a reminder, we plan for the program to run until 7 to 7:30 p.m. Today is our fifth program in our fall 2025 lineup. We are deeply grateful for your longstanding support from our community. Your help has allowed us to organize and grow our organization for 42 years, hosting speaker programs and experts joining us in person and online from across the world.
Good evening, everyone. I am Peter Gerlach, the ICFRC Executive Director. I am pleased and touched to see so many people in this room. As a small nonprofit, we exist because of the generosity of individuals like all of you. As we head into the last months of 2025, opportunities for nonprofit funding beyond individuals are becoming more difficult as charitable organizations like ours face a very uncertain future, especially when we are focused, like today, on uplifting research and stories advocating for marginalized, vulnerable, and international communities. For those who receive our newsletters and e-communications, and if you don't, please consider adding your first name and email on our website, you'll note that we have a wonderfully busy October, a sprint, if you will. Many programs, which I hope you will take a look at, that are similar in character to this one. We've also made significant progress in correcting the donation receiving functionality that was interrupted by FlipCause, which we've been using, which we're moving away from. So those issues are being resolved for those of you that had concerns about that. We sincerely ask each one of you to consider making a donation tonight or later on. You can do this by cash or check. We make it very easy with a QR code on the tables all around the room and the one right up there on the screen behind me. Please, please help us keep our free educational programs available year-round. This and attending our programs and helping spread the word is a tangible way. I truly, truly believe this, you guys. A tangible way that you can be actionable and help make a difference amidst these incredibly challenging times. So thank you all, and back to you, Ted.
Thanks, Peter. ICFRC would like to give a heartfelt thank you to today's sponsor and partner, the Iowa City Public Library, for providing partnership, space, and today's food. Our next program will be tomorrow, Saturday, the 4th of October at 4 p.m. on the Ped Mall. This program is titled the Togolese Celebration in Iowa. Celebrate with ICFRC during the 2025 African Festival of Arts and Culture. The program will feature traditional dancing by the virtuous Togolese women of Iowa. The performance will showcase the vibrant history and culture of the country's five regions. In conversation with the group's members, will enable Iowans to learn more about the West African nation, its people, and how Togolese migrants are building community in Johnson County. On Monday, the 13th of October at 6 p.m., we hope to see you here at the library for our Indigenous Peoples Day program, Indigenous Strength, Food Sovereignty, and Language Revitalization. Today's program is the second in our fall 2025 four-part series, Big Questions Confronting 2025. There are posters on your tables and on our website where you can find more information. Thank you to our series sponsors, Midwest One Bank, Delta Equity Capital, the University of Iowa Anthropology Department, the Iowa City Public Library, the Iowa City Senior Center, and Prairie Lights Books. The titles of the author's books, just to introduce them are, the titles of the series sessions are, What is Causing the Increasing Distrust in Healthcare, which was last Friday? Is the USA a Nation of Immigrants or a Deportation Nation, which is, of course, tonight? What are the costs of widespread economic inequality? And how does too much presidential power endanger democracy? I hope you will help spread the word about each of these incredibly important and timely conversations. Please see our website, icfrc.org, for more upcoming programs. And as a special treat for today's program, you also have noticed that you can purchase Adam and Lina Maria's books from Prairie Lights to continue your learning about today's important topic. The two books are entitled The Deportation Machine, America's Long History of Expelling Immigrants, and Fighting for Control, Power, Reproductive Care, and Race in the U.S.-Mexico Borderlands. And finally, I would like to now introduce our speakers. Dr. Adam Goodman is the author of the award-winning book, The Deportation Machine, America's Long History of Expelling Immigrants, which is a finalist for the Los Angeles Times Book Prize in History. His writing has appeared in outlets such as The Washington Post, The Nation, Time, and the Journal of American History. Goodman is a member of the Statue of Liberty Ellis Island Foundation History Advisory Committee and an associate professor in the Department of Latin American and Latino Studies at the University of Illinois, Chicago. Dr. Lina Maria Murillo is a feminist historian and associate professor in the Department of Women, Gender, and Sexuality Studies at the University of Texas, Austin. She received her doctorate in Borderlands History at the University of Texas, El Paso in 2016. Her research interests include borderlands, women's health, reproductive justice, Latinx studies, and social justice movements. Her first monograph, Fighting for Control, Power, Reproductive Care, and Race in the U.S.-Mexico Borderlands, is out now with UNC Press. In it, she examines the clinics, organizations, and institutions that help foster access to reproductive care across the border in the 20th century. Two other projects are also in progress. The first, tentatively titled Making Gilead, White Demographic Decline and the End of Democracy, which highlights how fears of white demographic decline have translated into a hostile legal and social environment for pregnant women and people in the last two centuries. The second project is a biography of the little-known abortion rights activist Patricia McGinnis, who in the years before Roe v. Wade established an organized abortion network across the U.S.-Mexico border. Please join me in welcoming Adam Goodman and Lina Maria Murillo. So I'm delighted to turn the conversation over to these esteemed scholars, but I thought it might be helpful just to start with a prompt to get the conversation going.
Yeah.
And instead of tiptoeing around the topic, I think we'll just dig right into it. How have public officials used force, coercion, and fear to purge immigrants from the country and exert control over those who remain?
So thank you so much for having us here tonight. Very special thank you to the Iowa City Foreign Relations Council for this wonderful invitation. And as I think many scholars now have to do, I will proceed by saying that even though I am employed by the University of Texas at Austin, I come here today as an expert in these topics, and I'm exerting my First Amendment right to freedom of speech. And that is something that we should be fighting for and demanding, especially from folks like myself, who have the expertise and the credentials to be able to speak thoughtfully and critically on these topics today. So I kind of want to center Iowa City. I've been living in this wonderful city for 7 years, and very sad that I had to leave. But as they say, from the pot and into the fire, from Iowa politics to Texas politics, it's a wild there too. But I want to center what's gone on in the last several months here, not just in Iowa City, but also in Iowa. We have seen a ratcheting up, right, of deportations. Not that they weren't existing already. I want to shout out the Prairie Land Freedom Fund, who has been working to support migrants and helping them with detention. They've been doing that for many years. And I'm going to shout out a lot of folks. So if people want to write notes, please do give these people money too, including Iowa City Foreign Relations Council, but also all these other organizations to do a lot of mutual aid in our community. But so they have been on the forefront of supporting undocumented folks and documented folks get out of detention. But right, just a few days ago, last week, right, there was a horrible arrest of Jorge Gonzalez inside Bread Garden, the arrest of Ian Roberts in Des Moines, who is the head of their public education system there. A few weeks or month or so before all of that happened, there was the arrest of Pedro Pascual, right, in West Liberty, And so there have been these sort of notable cases, but of course we don't know of the hundreds of cases, right, that go untold. And I think that's why we're at this moment where we need to talk about the history of deportation, of immigration, of forced kidnapping, you know, of kidnapping. This is what's going on right now. And in particular, I'm very excited to have this conversation with Adam tonight because of what's happening in Chicago, right? So at the same time that we've got these sort of skirmishes here in Iowa City, we were just talking about the raids that are occurring in Chicago. For those folks who are paying attention to, there was a raid last night, right, in South Chicago?
A couple nights ago, yeah.
Yeah, and it was a whole building. Women, children were let out in the middle of the night. There were Black Hawk helicopters. I mean, it was very dramatic. And so these, you know, as I've been talking with other colleagues, right, when you begin to kind of look into some of these cases, like some of these folks are wearing ankle monitors. They're not a flight risk. They have been going through the system as they were told. So then what are these sort of spectacles of detention meant to do, right? What are these kind of, these raids, and what are they meant to do? And they're meant to terrorize, right? They're meant to terrorize not just the communities that they are targeting, but the community as a whole, right? Everyone, whether or not you are a documented or undocumented resident, it is meant to strike fear in all of our hearts. And so as I've been rereading Adam's book, it has struck me the degree to which the machinery that was built, has been built for over 100 years, is just at its kind of nadir right now.
Yeah, well, before I pick that up, just a big thank you to the Iowa City Foreign Relations Council, to Prairie Lights, to Lena for being in conversation, and really to all of you for being here and for caring about this issue. I think now more than ever, or as ever, it's so important to be in community and to be thinking about these things together and thinking about how to best understand them as a first step to perhaps changing the realities that we're facing and that we're not happy with when it comes to policy locally, state level, or federal level. One of the things that struck me as I was researching and writing my book over the course of a decade, was that this history is much deeper than many people are aware, and that it's one that involves both Democratic administrations and Republican administrations. It didn't start in 2016 when Trump was elected for the first time. And in fact, there have been now more than 60 million people, 60 million, 6-0, deportations during the last century and a half. Most of those have happened in the last 50 or 60 years, since 1965. They've targeted certain groups for certain reasons at particular points in time, but as we see today, who's targeted has changed, but no one knows when it might be them and their families or their communities that end up in the spotlight and are the targets of incredibly punitive, inhumane immigration enforcement actions. And so when I started on this project, it really was to try to understand something that I couldn't quite wrap my head around. And this was in 2008, 2009, when we had a new president, Barack Obama, who came preaching hope and change, and in many ways was such an historic moment for this country, and one, I think, to celebrate, rightfully so. And at the same time, I couldn't understand why he was deporting hundreds of thousands of people each year. I couldn't wrap my head around that, couldn't understand that. And that's what kind of set me down this path. In addition to the fact that so many people were organizing in response to that, so many people were fighting back and trying to find the weak points in the machine, as I came to think of it, and to apply as much pressure as possible to them. And that's something that I'm sure has been happening here. And I'm looking forward to our broader conversation, to learning from all of you and to being in discussion with you today. But just to circle back to the question that Ted posed, oftentimes I think we have a really limited understanding, not today necessarily, because we're seeing it on full display, mm-hmm. but until the very recent past, we've had a limited understanding of what constitutes deportation. I think most people imagine that a deportation happens after some kind of due process plays out and someone has their kind of day in court in which they can make their case to an immigration judge, and based on the merits, that individual will decide whether or not the person can stay or whether or not they have to go. You know, that isn't happening today, but in fact, that hasn't happened, you know, for the better part of a century. You know, 85% of people deported during the last century and a half have been through expedited, streamlined means that give people little, if any, opportunity to fight for their case, to stay in the country. And I identified through my research a few different tactics and mechanisms, you know, that the federal government and also state and local governments have relied on. And we're seeing that on full display today. You know, one of the main mechanisms are formal deportations, which usually do take place, you know, through some kind of legal process involving an immigration judge. But those represent just a small sliver of the total. Again, 10 or 15% historically are just through these formal deportations. And in fact, the euphemistically termed voluntary departures, which are not voluntary at all, let me make that clear, which happen after someone has been apprehended, after someone has been taken into custody and presented with a number of different options. And this is the best of all the bad options in front of them. And they agree to leave the country, and in part to avoid spending who knows how long in detention, in part to lessen the consequences of being apprehended and potentially not being able to reenter the country in the future. And these have constituted the vast majority of apprehensions and deportations throughout U.S. history. Now, part of that has been because the U.S. Immigration Service has never had the funding or the political support to actually carry out the formal deportations. You know, we might be at a moment of change right now, you know, where you have a new law which has increased the funding for immigration enforcement 15-fold, and we really don't know what I think the future looks like. There's a big kind of question mark there, but I think we should all be very concerned. And to finalize this kind of trio of mechanisms that I identified, to circle back to Lena's point, you know, these scare tactics and fear campaigns meant to get people to self-deport, those have been used throughout U.S. history as well. And they've been kind of a tried and true method. And we see that today, in fact, now as the official Department of Homeland Security policy. If you've seen any of the advertisements or the videos that they promote on social media, or maybe you've received your email, in fact, this is now kind of, you know, official, explicit policy, not being said, you know, under one's breath, but actually, you know, stated very clearly that they're hoping that people will leave on their own, in part to carry out, you know, more enforcement actions than they otherwise would be able to. And so I think in understanding the present moment, we shouldn't say or shouldn't think that things have always been the same. We should identify key points of change. I spent part of the afternoon walking around downtown here, my first time in Iowa City. I'm really happy to be here. And, you know, spent some time walking around, having coffee, and thinking about as well, what are some of the things that are different or new about this moment? And I think we can get into that as well.
Mm-hmm. To talk about history, as two historians, one of the things that I think has, I guess, often turns people's stomach in our most recent past is the family separation policy that was under President Trump. Just today, I was reading an article in The Intercept that said they had come across a memo that had just come out focused on children who have been left by their parents because the parents have been deported, and DHS is offering children, I think, $2,500. So children, some of whom are U.S. citizens, so $2,500 to self-deport as a stipend is what DHS is calling this. And so DHS is also working with HHS, right? So HHS is run by RFK, right? So a lot of these children have been put into the foster care system, right? And so they are offering these children, $2,500 is a lot of money for me, I can't imagine, for children 14 and older to self-deport. And as I was rereading Adam's book and also thinking about my own work, the degree to which for the last 100 years children have been the kind of undiscussed, although I have a wonderful graduate student who I saw in the audience who's working on thinking about the rhetoric around children and deportation and detention, and they're doing beautiful work in their dissertation. Abby, somewhere there she is. There she is. Who's looking at the issue of children. Yay, Abby. Abby's doing beautiful work. Who's doing really interesting work to think about the role of children and what, in my book, I'm looking at the role of reproduction and the fear of non-white reproduction along the U.S.-Mexico border. And so this intense overlap of decades worth of cruelty against mostly non-white populations in the United States and an attack on their families. I come at this work as a reproductive justice scholar, and reproductive justice is a sort of broader framework that was developed by Black feminists and feminists of color that in some ways says, yes, we need reproductive rights, but we also need a framework that grounds us in beyond sort of civil rights, but grounds us in our human rights. So reproductive justice posits that people have a right to have children, they have a right not to have children, and they have a right to be able to have their children in safe and sustainable communities, right? And so oftentimes I think about the violence of the immigration machine, right, of the regime of immigration in the U.S. as reproductive violence against family formation, against children. And, you know, some of the images that Adam has in his book, and I wish I could put them on the screen, but are of children being deported with their parents in the 1940s. And I, in my own research, when I was reviewing the work of Catholic activists along the U.S.-Mexico border, the Catholics be showing up sometimes, guys. Shout out to the Catholic Worker House also, because they're doing beautiful work in Iowa City. It was a group of Catholics across the country, but really they were doing a lot of work in the 1930s, late 1920s, early 1930s, during a moment of mass deportation of Mexican origin people, a period that in Chicano studies they call it the repatriation period, but of course it was forced, people forced to flee. But this organization would talk to folks who were caught in detention centers, again, in places like El Paso, Texas, which remains a sort of hub of detention today. And I remember looking through letters that some of these Catholic activists were sending to family members, mostly to husbands, mm-hmm. in places as far away as Chicago, saying, your wife and your child have been detained in El Paso, Texas. They are in a detention jail. Can you send funds and support to help release them? Again, this is like 1932, 1933. So we should be horrified, right, that children are being detained today. But in fact, there's a long history to this kind of apprehension in the U.S. And the fact that we have built an infrastructure to detain children, you know, as young as newborn, is an abomination in any country, but certainly a country who touts itself as being the beacon of democracy and of freedom, and even more so for people who call themselves pro-life. What life, right? If you are thinking through the reproductive justice framework, how is that supporting life if you are detaining children and their mothers and their parents, right?
Well, I don't know if you heard or saw the Pope's comments But.
Yes. Oh, my God. I mean, not that I was, like, echoing Leo, but here I am echoing Pope Leo. But, yes, I mean, yeah. Very much, yeah.
Yeah. You know, something that comes to mind as you're speaking, Lena, is, you know, so many of the enforcement-first policies that the Trump administration promised on the campaign trail and has carried out since, and other administrations in the past as well, are based on this idea, this false notion, that we can easily separate immigrants, citizens, people who have legal status, people who don't have legal status, and when in reality, you know, people's lives are, surprise, surprise, you know, intricately intertwined in family, neighborhood, community, networks. And I think most people don't realize, you know, how often, in fact, they are interacting with someone who is in the country either without documents or with some kind of temporary legal status or provisional legal status. And so when something happens locally, like just this past week here, I mean, it hits home in a different way. And I think actually we've seen public opinion on this issue change dramatically. You know, first, during the campaign, record levels of support for mass deportation. But that since has been actually flipped to the other side. People no longer support that. And oftentimes I think it's in the concrete when it's, you know, the guy who runs the coffee shop down the street or someone who works at the local market or someone who is the father of your kid's friend at school who you know who is a target of enforcement action, who's not a violent criminal, who's not et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so, you know, one of the things that I think we can recognize is the way that immigration enforcement is affecting everyone, regardless of their legal status, albeit not in the same way. You know, let me emphasize that. But it is affecting everyone in the country in a lot of different ways that we might not realize at first glance. And also the fact that these policies are not done necessarily with the best interests of the country in mind, or of citizens for that matter, but the best interest of one person, and that's the person who's occupying the White House right now. You know, the Trump administration has used immigration as the issue that they've turned to time and again for their own political gain and benefit, and done so very successfully. And let's be clear about that. You know, it helped propel him into the White House this second time around. And whenever there's something going around or going on that's kind of polling low, or they want to change the news cycle, they're going to go back to immigration and kind of return to that. It's kind of a tried and true tactic. And for Trump, I actually don't know his true beliefs and how much he actually cares about immigration. I know the people who surround him are very much serious ideologues and extreme restrictionists who really value human life differently, depending on who you are, where you're from. And what's different now is that those people are the center of power. In the past, that had not been the case. They were kind of on the fringes, influencing policy, perhaps through lobbying and campaigning. But now they're in the White House. And so it's those factors that I think we can, you know, help put front and center in understanding where we're at today and why immigration is the issue, you know, for this administration. And that's something that actually sets the Trump administration apart. I can't think of another time in U.S. history where immigration has been the number one issue. I mean, there's been other instances where people have used it for political gain and benefit, but it's not been the single issue that they care about most and they return to time and again. So recognizing that and recognizing what's driving some of the actions or what's driving some of the policies is, I think, really important to understanding both what's happening, but also deflecting any kind of notion that there's some kind of inherent deservingness or value or worth or the lack thereof of the people who are targeted by immigration enforcement actions.
And I, since you brought up politics, I'll also say that it was disheartening. I know during the election last year to see some of our local politicians here in the state of Iowa who are running for as progressives, but who all jumped on the deportation bandwagon and came out sometimes forcefully, sometimes in YouTube videos, asking for donations with our local sheriff, saying that they would not allow Iowa City or Johnson County or what have you to become overrun with immigrants, and that they would be a part of the deportation machine. These were progressive candidates. so-called progressive, thank you, candidates. So my point is that we also need to be very thoughtful. I'm assuming that everybody here cares about their neighbors, cares about the community in which they live, cares about the violence that is being perpetrated by the state among some of the most marginalized people in our community, whether they are undocumented, whether they are trans and queer community members, that there are people that are willing to sell us out to score political points. And when it is no longer politically expedient, they'll go out to the Ped Mall and cry and say, oh, we should never have allowed ICE to come into our grocery store and assault one of our residents, when these folks just 6 months before were advocating and suggesting that they would be willing to work with the local sheriff's office in support of ICE and CBP, right? So we also need to, as educated and deeply grounded in a sense of human rights, that we also need to align our politics and hold our own politicians who suggest that they are speaking on our behalf to account for selling out certain people in our community who right now are you know, under the scope, under surveillance by the federal government. And so we should think, like, right, nationally, certainly that's also important. But I think for many people here, that sometimes feels so big, yeah, right? That feels overwhelming and too big. And so how do we hold space in a community like Iowa City, in a county like Johnson County, which is one of the last remaining blue dots in an ocean of red? And how do we also open the door for folks who are living maybe not in Johnson County, but who agree with many of the positions of the people who live here, right? Who are living sometimes in very rural spaces and are dealing with ICE, right? Are dealing with CBP, and they need community, right? How do we open the door to those folks? And I think thinking about both of our books together, it always is grounding to know how folks have been active and been activated in the past through sort of mutual aid organizing and networking to help push back during these moments of, like, extreme violence.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, that's the flip side that I think often people don't realize. You don't hear about it as much. But for as long as there have been apprehensions, detentions, deportations, there have been people organizing and trying their best to figure out any way possible to protect themselves and their families and their community members. I mean, as is logical, yeah. You know, what would you do, you know, if it was you and your family or your mom or your brother, et cetera, that was facing mm-hmm. potential removal?
Yeah.
I mean, there's a couple of things I wanted to mention to circle back as well and tie some of these points together. I mean, one, I guess, is the question of, you know, why is the strategy of demonizing and scapegoating immigrants effective? Mm-hmm. You know, I think it's important to recognize that, you know, people across the United States, both locally but in communities, I'm sure, here and then in Chicago and that general metropolitan area as well as elsewhere, mm-hmm. like, are suffering and have real needs and have real problems that need to be addressed by different policy solutions. You know, it's much easier for a politician or president to point the finger and to blame immigrants in the abstract for those real problems. But that's part of the reason why it resonates. Mm-hmm. There's kind of a bait and switch happening. Mm-hmm. And it's important to kind of recognize that as well, not just kind of that they shouldn't be blaming immigrants for problems that they're not responsible for or that they're not causing, but what are the policy responses that would actually address people's concerns and needs? And I do think actually immigration policy and public opinion about it, you know, will shift as people realize potentially that the crackdown we've seen in the last months and probably for the rest of this administration, you know, actually isn't delivering on what it promised. It's not bettering people's lot in so many ways. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the other thing that I think is important to recognize at this time, to kind of go back to the optimistic side of things, as overwhelming and sometimes depressing as things can be, is that, you know, these moments really create opportunities as well. I mean, it's helpful from the perspective of an organizer to have a common enemy. Mm-hmm. It's helpful to have something to rally around. That can be really politicizing and energizing. And also there's an opportunity potentially to push elected officials. You know, Democrats, I think, are more susceptible to political pressure at this point in time than the Republicans. But the Democrats don't have a great track record. In fact, if there was a time where I thought there might have been a change, it was 2020 when Biden was running and really plotting out a different path from his opponent, which he didn't really follow through on, like so many Democrats before him. Talked a big game on immigration, but they actually just let it kind of slide once they're elected, in part because the opinion polling said it wouldn't be to their benefit. And instead of actually developing a core set of beliefs and values and politics, as Trump has done on the other side, the Democrats really have swayed on this issue. You know, if you look at Kamala Harris's platform or Biden's platform, really, or Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama, you know, it's very much pro-enforcement. The latter two, probably even more pro-enforcement than George W. Bush in 2000, 2004. Mm-hmm. Just to give you a sense of how much things have changed, how far the Overton window has moved, or what's politically possible. So, you know, I really think it's important for people to, you know, think about how to push for elected officials, again, Democrats in this case, who are susceptible to political pressure, to really take up this issue, to develop a set of politics around it and to embrace it, and to actually push for it as hard on the other side as Trump has on the punitive, restrictive side. Because if anything, he's shown how much one can do. And I think that's really important, I think, you know, going forward, which we haven't really seen. We haven't really seen historically or in the recent past, but there's tremendous opportunity. And I think what most people care about, maybe many of you in this room, is actually voting for politicians that seem to believe what they say and have a core set of beliefs that they embrace and can, you know, tell you.
Yeah.
It's not changing every 4 years.
That would be delightful.
You know, I mean, is that too much to ask? But I actually think it's politically efficacious in addition to being kind of morally grounded.
I want to kind of steer... steer us in a slightly different direction, but I just want to shout out the mayor of Chicago, who I think has done a brilliant job at, like, embodying their core beliefs. And, like, every time I see him speaking, he's just, like, shuts people down and basically says, I believe in human rights. I just overwhelmingly believe in human rights. I understand the history of colonization of the United States. Like, I will not engage in support for the deportation of undocumented people, full stop. Right. I also think of Mamdani in New York as somebody who is just, like, obliterating kind of the messaging of the right as a Muslim person, as a non-white person, as somebody who even the Democrats are afraid of, right? Because his message is so deeply rooted in progressive human rights values. I mean, his stance on Palestine and Israel is certainly one that I wish people on our side would take more to heart. And so, thank you. And thank you for that. I'm just shouting out other people doing beautiful things. So it can be done, is my point, right? Like, there are models for how you enact a politic that is deeply rooted in humanity and in human rights and an ethic of care and love and compassion. It's not like there aren't people doing it. But I wanted to circle back to a comment you made about, why is immigration one of those, like, why is it so easy to deploy immigration or attacks against immigrants for political expediency, right? Just, you know, to be able to sort of mobilize certain parts of the conservative base. And to be fair, right, again, there are conservative parts of the Democratic Party as well. We can't forget the Clinton administration. I mean, they were the ones that started building the wall to begin with. And really, under the Clinton administration, we see the beginning and the expansion of militarization, right? And then again, under Obama. I mean, we can't deny that these things were happening under Democratic presidencies as well, right? So that is important to say. But I come back to the history of white supremacy in the United States. What does it mean? I would argue that I do think that Trump has a core belief on immigration, and that is that he is a white supremacist. And he has been a white supremacist from the time that he was a landlord in New York City and his father was a landlord, right? I mean, they were sued by the federal government for their racist politics against black tenants, right, in New York City. So I don't think that this is, that he does not have a core belief. I think that he has found a groundswell of support by extremists in his party that, as you said, are no longer on the margins. I was talking to another graduate student yesterday who's just doing really frightening, to be honest with you, work on the John Birch Society and looking at the history of the John Birch, a far right-wing white supremacist, white nationalist organization. And he's writing about their take on Vietnam in 1969. And I'm reading his paper, my student's paper, and then I was like, wait, let me go back to what Pete Hegseth was just saying in his historic speech to the military men at Quantico. And friends, the overlap was absolutely bone-chilling. This is rhetoric directly taken from the John Birch Society from 1969, right? An organization that was considered and still considered absolutely fringe. And this is what is being repeated to an audience of military men, mostly men, if you saw pictures, some women, but mostly men, and likely not many women into the foreseeable future, who are then tasked to go and proliferate these ideas about U.S. empire and the importance, the centrality of white supremacy to the continuation of U.S. empire. And what did Trump say? He said, we need to begin this at home. There are cities, right? There are cities that could use, you can use as training grounds, right? And to go back to what Adam had said about the budget that Homeland Security just received. This is larger than, I think it's like the next, I mean, just the budget, not of the military, but just the budget of ICE is larger than, I don't know how, like the top 20 militaries in the world. Thank you, Victor, for that. Again, if that is the case, and then the President of the United States is telling people to start at home, telling the military of the United States to start at home, and that these are ideas that are echoes from the John Birch Society from 1969 have found their way to us in 2025. We haven't seen anything yet, right? They're just getting started. And so for me, all of these things are kind of like the ties, bringing all of this, weaving all of this together. The deportation machine on steroids, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think certainly something we're seeing today is that there have been moments in the past where immigration enforcement officials have, you know, targeted people for questions related to labor and economics, racial discrimination, racial profiling, political ideology. And there's kind of different moments in time you can point to and examine, and historians have studied in depth. And I think today we're seeing everything all at once.
Yeah.
Like it's all on the table, as we're seeing through various examples. Mm-hmm. And you know, what we don't know yet are kind of the long-term effects of these policies. You know, one of the things I found in my book and researching the course of the 20th century in terms of who was targeted, late 19th into the 20th century, who was targeted and why, are the longstanding effects that those immigration enforcement actions have on questions of belonging or membership or the very ideas that we create or come to take for granted about who is an American, who is deserving, who belongs, right? So in the late 19th century, when you know, Chinese immigrants and Chinese laborers especially were the primary focus of the deportation machine, that created certain ideas about their excludability. And they were restricted from immigrating for the better part of 60 years. Mm-hmm. Southern and Eastern Europeans, who were really targeted in the first decades of the 20th century and excluded and restricted from immigrating for four decades. People from Italy, people from Poland, Jews from across Eastern Europe. And then really, for the latter two-thirds of the 20th century, mostly Mexicans, who came to be about 9 out of every 10 people deported throughout U.S. history. So this kind of false equation of the so-called illegal immigrant or undocumented person was someone who's Mexican or Latino more broadly. And that, in part, is the product of the disproportionate targeting of Mexican migrants, who the United States depended on for labor historically, because they had excluded a lot of other groups and no longer had sources of labor coming from Southern Eastern Europe or from Asia. Mm-hmm. And that in part led to the creation of both a cyclical effect of a ramp up of enforcement on the border. So in recent years, prior to this recent infusion of funds, about 18,000 of the 20,000 Border Patrol agents in the United States are stationed on the U.S.-Mexico border. There's a lot of other miles, mm-hmm. thousands of miles on both the coast and the U.S.-Canada border. 18,000 to 20,000 agents are stationed on the U.S.-Mexico border. Mm-hmm. So, something that really has changed in recent years, and this is a dramatic shift, is that I think who's come to be targeted is now much more diverse than it had been really up until the last 10 years or so, mm-hmm. And we've seen now people of all different nationalities and backgrounds, really, in particular places where they have strong communities, that'll vary. But if you look at the apprehension statistics that the Department of Homeland Security puts out, it's now much more eclectic and diverse. And what the longstanding effects of that will be mm-hmm. is something that I think we should, keep in mind and also be mindful of, rather than taking for granted just what we're reading about from the government press releases or from the news for that matter. I would just encourage everyone to take a step back when you're reading a news article about immigration. Who are they quoting? Are they just going to government officials and kind of parroting whatever the press release says? Are they talking to a diverse array of people who maybe are on different sides of this issue or have different opinions? Historically, at least, that hasn't been the case. And in fact, there's been a disproportionate practice of citing and turning to government officials who have a vested interest in these narratives, which is actually one of the really concerning things, I think, about, among other things, about this recent infusion of funds, is that there's a certain amount of bureaucratic inertia that builds up over time. And once the detention centers are constructed, once the ICE agents increases by however many hundreds or thousands, it's going to be very difficult for someone to then cut that back in the future or to close a detention center, which a small community maybe depends on for labor and employment. And so I think the longstanding effects, even if there are shifting politics from the top down, it could be really difficult to dismantle some of these things.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the fact that the Supreme Court of the United States is now very openly codifying into law, the profiling of communities of color, the fact that they essentially said it was legal for ICE agents and other DHS agents to profile people who don't look American or are not speaking English or are not are working in particular places, again, should give us all pause. And I have really great conversations with my students, and I'm thinking about all the wonderful ones I had here at the University of Iowa. And I remember teaching, this is last semester, about the history of Japanese internment in the United States. And the reason why I often teach about that is I grew up in San Jose, California. This was the first Japantown ever in the U.S. is in San Jose. Very vibrant Japanese community. And I remember when they began to commemorate the history of Japanese internment in San Jose, because this community was essentially torn apart. And if you walk down the street, you can see their placards on the ground that tell you what happened in that particular area when the detentions and deportations and the moving of people into detention camps began. And then there are placards around Japantown that tell you, the history. And so they say on this day, everyone was rounded out from their homes and brought to this particular area on the corner of this street and this street. And then they were all walked down to San Jose State, the university. And they were held on the campus of San Jose State for 2 weeks. And I tell that story because oftentimes when students were hearing about this sort of all the discourse and the rhetoric around immigration, oftentimes they would say, oh, they can't deport 11 million people. That's not going to happen. I mean, that's just discourse. They're just talking about these things. They're not actually going to make it real. And so taking it back to these historical moments and saying they may not be able to deport all 11 million, but they're going to try because they've done it in the past, right? And what struck me about walking around this area in San Jose was how quickly the government was able to wrest resources from the city, from the county, to enable the removal of thousands of Japanese families, right? Because these were also children, women, and men. And how quickly they were able to construct these detention centers and throw people into them, right? The train system that still works today was how people were, maneuvered all across the country, not just in California. And they didn't have as much money as they have now, right? And they also, at the time, did not have the private infrastructure. Because one thing is what the federal government is doing. The other is what private corporations are doing and the amount of taxpayer money that these corporations are going to earn by creating these massive detention centers, right? And as some of you who have driven that I-80, the most delightful I-80 from Iowa City all the way to Nebraska, shout out to my Nebraskans who are here. There's a lot of open prairie on that space, friends. And we don't always know or see what is being constructed in our own backyard, right? When communities may not even know that their local governments have sold out areas of land where they can construct private detention centers, right? And with the rise of AI, they may not need a lot of people to police those places or surveil them, right? So we are on a precipice of a new world, right? I do think it is incumbent upon us to read the histories of these issues so that we know what came before and to prepare ourselves for what is to come, because this this is a turning point, right? This is a massive turning point in our history.
I want to make sure we open up for conversation,
yes,
but
absolutely.
my last one line is that not to lose sight of the fact that, you know, there are particular decisions that real people made that have brought us to this point, and a different set of decisions by politicians, people in power, who are perhaps pressured by those in the community, like many of you here, could lead us in a different direction. Mm-hmm. I don't want to give a sense of inevitability.
Yeah, absolutely.
But it's important to kind of keep that in mind, and also to know that we don't know what's going to happen moving forward.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, with that, I would sort of remind everyone, is this on?
Yeah.
I want to remind everyone that the books are on sale outside, right? We talk about reading the history, learning the history. There's two excellent books just outside the door that we can acquire. So I want to open it up for Q&A. And I would just ask that everyone just keep it to one question and just speak into the microphone, and I'll come to you so we can record your questions in the Q&A.
Thank you for your work. Thank you for leading this discussion, and thank you for the conclusions that you've brought to the discussion already. There's an odd relationship in the history of the United States between progressivism, racism, and deportation. And Woodrow Wilson's probably the one to look to for that, because he was he ran on a program of deportation, and Teddy Roosevelt was not to be outdone, and he ran on the same program. And so if I say something briefly about this, I would say that historians are often in the business of examining the cultural, political DNA of the United States, and there's nothing more American than nativism.
Yeah.
And so when we look at who's being marginalized, it is very important to look at who benefits from that. And the break point, and I'll stop in just a second, but the break point is slavery. And the notion that slavery is some sort of hyper-nativism is one to consider. So mm-hmm. Thank you.
And I would say people who are working on the history of reproduction have certainly used that as an important breaking point in that. And actually, Adam and I both talk about the sort of history of population control and desire for demographic fears certainly animated most of the history of eugenics in the United States. And nativism has certainly been also animated by eugenics and eugenicists. And so there are folks who are and have been writing about this moment, in the 1850s and 1860s, when there is this explosion of non-white people all of a sudden coming into American society, and whether formerly enslaved people or immigrants who are coming from Eastern Europe, but also from Latin America, who are somewhere on the racial spectrum, but not in the white part. And so really that is when eugenics is born, right? In some ways as a way to justify the continuation of a racial hierarchy that could not continue in the same way as it had because of the loss of slavery, right? And so many of us are trying to think about what does demographic change have to do with immigration as a powerful tool of white supremacy, right? And I think you put your finger on it.
Oh. Then we had a question over here, and then can other hands in the back? Okay, I'll circle around.
Hi, great to see you, Lena. I have lots of thoughts and we'll talk later, but maybe kind of building off of the economic element of all this, I'm wondering if you could maybe unpack the kind of seeming contradiction between an economy that depends on immigrant labor and the deportation machine. And, in the state, farm laborers, all like just the number of sectors that actually depend on it, and how we've seen these deals that get made after a ban to allow certain populations in as kind of exceptional. And I'm wondering what you think that says about the deportation machine, the kind of sustainability of these contradictions, or just more broadly, what this kind of seeming contradiction and says, and the reason it continues, and it's just difficult to square.
It's a really important point. It also speaks to this kind of contradiction of sorts, where immigrants are blamed for both stealing jobs and depending on public welfare. You know, there's such hard workers, but also doing nothing and just depending on the state. But I think you're pointing to something really essential in that it speaks to the political efficacy of using harsh enforcement policies for personal gain. But when it comes down to it, and what the nation depends on, and what constituents depend on, and actually a lot of Trump supporters depend on, are continued labor force, as you mentioned. And so you even saw, amid this historic, in their words, deportation campaign, that they all of a sudden made certain exceptions, where they said, oh, we're going to pull back a little bit in services and in agriculture, in part because they're getting, pushed to do so. And exactly how that works itself out internally within the administration, I'm not sure, because I'm sure there's a lot of people in the administration that don't care about what those economic interests are saying. They want to go with the harsh enforcement policies regardless. But then there's some that really do want to take that into account. And it does speak to the fact that we're not working in this perfect economic system in which an immigrant takes a job that an American citizen would have taken otherwise. It's not as if, there's a one-to-one transference there.
Mm-hmm. So I maybe spend too much time in some really scary news places. So one of the things that I have been seeing, and it's part of the prison industrial complex right now today in the United States, right, is the ability to farm out detained people, right? And they're doing it already in places like Arizona. So, yes, capitalism will continue even more robustly than ever, right? Because now they have a detained population, and they can demand, force, right, that detained population to work for nothing, right? We already do it to imprisoned people in the United States, right? During the pandemic, there were people in Iowa making our face masks and our, right? So their prison labor exists. And so this is a way to make it, to expedite it even more so, right? So they are already detaining people, farm workers in places like Arizona, and then re-shipping out that labor to farms, right? But now everybody has an ankle monitor, and they've been detained, and now they're working, instead of making, whatever, $10 a day, now they're making 5 cents a day, right? And so this is, I feel like, a transition moment where they're trying to figure out how they can do this, right? Because they can't do it all at once. A dear friend of ours just sent out an article to our text thread with some of my dear feminist scholars. And it said, there's fascism thrives on normalcy, on making everybody feel like, look, nothing has changed. Maybe something weird will happen one day and you're like, oh, that's odd, right? But there's going to come a moment when we might see our fruit and vegetable prices drop, where they keep saying, don't worry about the tariffs, don't worry about the tariffs, because they have other plans for how they're going to ameliorate the cost of things. And that is by using the labor of undocumented people at, essentially for nothing. But that takes time, right? These are massive systems, agricultural systems, the meatpacking industry. This will take time, right? So there are bits and starts to this. As historians, we know this, right? The machine doesn't always work on full steam. But it seems to me that this is the things that they are attempting in various parts already of the United States. And again, the perfect example that they already have is the prison industrial complex, right? So, it's not unimaginable that they're going to do this with undocumented people, right?
I don't know. Oh, can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
All right. Hi. I just wanted to take advantage of having two historians this evening. Yes. Out of the inside of the United States and thinking from outside of the United States, and particularly sort of historically the role of the United States in destroying markets, in supporting dictatorships, and basically creating the conditions under which people need to escape and people need to go somewhere, mm-hmm. and then benefiting from the need of these people to escape and to seek a better life, and coming here and then getting treated like second-class citizens after having been pushed out by the very country that is treating them like that. So I was wondering if perhaps you could, I know we don't have very much time, but that is something that I don't hear much about in these conversations. Absolutely. That it's sort of a full circle that doesn't quite close properly, I guess, if that's maybe an incorrect metaphor, but it's something I've often thought of in that way.
Yeah, thanks for that question. Just briefly, a really important point as well is I think, you know, the United States has this reputation as a nation of immigrants, right? But that very idea, or that myth of sorts, makes us think of an immigrant as a certain type of person who's seeking economic betterment, who's coming here to make a better life for themselves by choice, plans to stay, ends up settling, incorporating themselves, you know, and their family has an upward trajectory over the course of generations. So many people, as you note, come for a wide variety of reasons. You know, they come because they're escaping political violence or climate change related conditions in their countries. They come because perhaps, as you say, the United States was involved in their very countries as well, whether it's economically, militarily, or otherwise. You know, there's a saying that some people may have heard, but we're here because you were there. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, so many people come to this country as refugees or those seeking asylum. And I think it ultimately makes us kind of interrogate and question the utility of the nation of immigrants framing, which we should note also leaves out a whole lot of other people, people whose ancestors were brought here during the time of chattel slavery, didn't come by choice at all, came by force and chains. Indigenous people who occupied this land before immigrants came to the United States, where do they fit in the nation of immigrants narrative? So you're pointing to something really important, where the nation of immigrants narrative, I think, is politically useful at this time, to celebrate the United States as the nation of immigrants, but there are also certain limits when we actually consider who's included in that framing.
Mm-hmm. And I'll just say, as somebody who's, my parents are immigrants to the United States, and they came for as economic immigrants, but certainly from Latin America, but certainly the history of places like Central America. I mean, my God, the United States decimated El Salvador, Nicaragua, Honduras. Those of you who, I'm sure there's many of you here who were in solidarity organizing in the 1980s, late 1970s, 1980s, and know the sort of the history of the Iran-Contra ordeal in Central America, that, those countries were never the same again. And then coupled with, as Adam was saying, climate change and economic devastation, right? And this is just, quote unquote, in our own backyard, right? In Central America, this is not to mention places like Haiti, that have been, the playground of where the U.S. gets to, go and decimate and destroy and upend democratically elected governments. It seems like every other decade, and destabilize that country. And there's massive immigration from Haiti. At this particular moment, right? And in fact, because a lot of Haitians have not been allowed to cross the U.S.-Mexico border as asylum seekers, now there's these, thriving Haitian communities in places like Tijuana, where there's, this interesting, cross-cultural, creation of new foods. But all of this is due in part to U.S. Foreign policy and U.S. involvement, not to mention Arab countries that have, since the 1940s, been dealing with U.S. empire causing mass immigration. But, of course, we're not allowed to talk about those histories. We're not allowed to connect those histories. We're now allowed to acknowledge that those histories exist, right? Some of you may remember during the Biden administration, Kamala Harris was tasked to go down to Central America and say, please don't come here. And these people were like, what are you, what are you talking about? Like, you don't come here, right? Like, you leave us alone. And so I think we don't talk about the history of U.S. empire in conjunction with the history of immigration enough publicly,
yeah.
Right? We haven't reckoned with it in the public sphere in the way that we should.
Yeah, I do think, just a side note, I do think that's where the scholarship has moved in recent years.
Yeah, absolutely.
Where so much of the work that's come out recently and will be coming out in the years ahead, you know, really gets at the very question you're asking.
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh. Hi. I hope this isn't too much of a fatalist or broad question, but what protections remain in place that kind of prevent another Mexican Repatriation Act? What kind of protections prevents the administration from performing another Mexican Repatriation Act?
I was going to say, I don't think there are any. And if I remember correctly, Stephen Miller point one, and for those of you who don't know who Stephen Miller is, please Google and be prepared to be scared. But Stephen Miller point one, if I'm not mistaken, talked about Mexican repatriation and also talked about Japanese internment, as these are laws that are still on the books, right? Like that the government, yes. There are so many laws that are still, that have not been, because the country moved in a different direction, have not been utilized, right? Coercive eugenic sterilization, that is still federally legal in the United States. Yes, in the United States of America, states themselves have passed laws, to make it illegal, but federally, that still remains. Buck v. Bell still remains a Supreme Court case that has not been overturned, right? So there are still laws on the books that can easily be kind of, turned on, started, reignited.
I mean, also, when it comes to immigration, so much lies within the authority of the executive branch.
Yeah.
As we've learned, if you've been paying attention.
Yeah.
In the last year. And, that's something that I think is incredibly concerning, certainly with the political alignments that we have now. And also these questions of immigration federalism, what power do cities have or what powers do states have to resist or push back? And the reality is some, but not that much. Mm-hmm. Chicago police officers or Chicago authorities can't do much when federal officials are carrying out raids and immigration operations in the city. They can stand by in case, but they can't stop the agents from carrying out the apprehensions and deportations. And so I think we're seeing in real time, it circles back to this really important point, I think, of kind of how to bring about political and social change, right? And I think that it needs to be two-pronged, not just kind of defensively responding to horrible things that are happening, but also developing a proactive strategy in politics moving forward that would actually prevent and cut off some of these things from happening in the first place. And I think it also matters a lot in terms of on-the-ground organizing and pressure from below. But as we've seen as well, it certainly matters who's in power. Who the elected officials are certainly matters. It's not just as if the pressure from below can do everything. You need to have partners in positions of power and also people running for positions of power, perhaps, for the first time who want to carry out change. We need both kind of top-down and bottom-up.
I was just curious how, reproductive labor offered by immigrants would be affected by the, current attack and policies against immigrants themselves. Like, what are the consequences that we're seeing from that and, that we will see or might?
So I write a lot about reproductive labor in my book when I look at the history of Mexican origin women and their work as domestic workers in people's homes, as caregivers, right? These are the folks who are caring for elders, continue to care for elders right now, right? Who, in many cases, are helping to raise the next generation of children. Again, a shout out to another organization, Neighborhood Centers, who's a beautiful organization that has created all of these incredible child care centers across the city, predominantly staffed by migrant women, right? I was volunteering with them, and it rips my heart open to think that there could be a raid at one of those places, right? It would decimate. It would completely decimate that community, because where do immigrant mothers go and leave their children where they know their children are going to be taken care of, fed, and kept safe while their moms are at Walmart working their 10-hour shift, right? This is like that is very real, right? The work that many of these people are doing in our very community right now that would completely upend, right? Not just the economy, but our sense of stability and security and, our society, right? And that is where I think, you know, to Adam's point, the work that we need to do, shoring up organizations that are already engaged in this kind of work, right? So I mentioned the Catholic Worker House. There is Escucha Mi Voz that has been, you know, beautifully kind of at the front lines of physically putting their bodies in the way of, right, like at the jail in Cedar Rapids where a lot of detained people are being sent, right? And so actually going and putting their bodies on the line. The Catholic Worker House, I have it all here. The Immigrant Welcome Network of Johnson County is also a newly established organization that's doing really wonderful and beautiful work. And the Center for Worker Justice, which sadly just recently closed, but was doing wonderful activism for laborers in the community to make sure that their wages were not stolen, right, by greedy bosses in the Johnson County area. So to me, that is like where we go, right? We go and we work with communities that already exist. We expand their networks, right, to protect the folks who are just trying to live, right? They're just trying to live and provide for their families and for their communities. But in a place like Iowa City, I have seen it firsthand. If our caregivers are rounded up, like the infrastructure of this city would crumble, right? Like its economic and also cultural and community infrastructure would just crumble. Yeah, so thank you.
I think you touched on this. They are using high-profile cases, I think, to plant fear in the society. And is there any legal, you mentioned organizations and working as groups, but are there structural counter action to the administration who's trying to plant fear? I mean, they are, I don't know about the numbers, if the numbers of detained people are a lot more now than they were before. It seems to, they seem to be, but you probably are. Are they increasing over time? And is that an issue, I guess? I mean, you mentioned that the some of the Democratic administrations have detained possibly more than previous Republican administration. Is that number increasing over time? Is that the issue of birth rate, I guess, or other issues playing roles here? And what is, I mean, the high-profile actions they are taking, the current administration, how can that be contained and reacted to? Does the progressive have power, or are they just going to use their bodies? Do they have legal power?
I mean, about the detention point, you know, more people are detained right now than ever have been in U.S. history. And that's increased dramatically in the last 5 years. You know, I think for a long time, there's a law in the books that required there to be 34,000 detention beds available. And you can imagine how having kind of a quota like that would incentivize the Immigration Service to keep those filled. During the pandemic, because in part because of the real dangers related to public health and people living in institutional spaces, the number dropped dramatically. And I want to say it was down to 10,000 or 15,000, 19,000. I mean, it was cut in half and then some. And now I think it's close to 60,000 people. And the amount of money that's just passed in this recent law dedicated to detention is going to take it even higher potentially. So we don't know what's going to happen on that front. But I do think it's incredibly concerning, in part because I was saying kind of the institutional bureaucratic inertia. Once those detention beds are created and available, there will be incentive to keep them filled. You know, your other question, I think, maybe Lena, you have more optimistic advice
no,
or thoughts.
No, it's going to be bad when I say something.
But, you know, it's very difficult. I think it's very difficult because they're really trying anything and everything. We've seen from everything from threats to birthright citizenship.
I was just going to mention the birthright citizenship. So, you know, it's before the Supreme Court at this very moment, although they sort of, they said, yes, you can go ahead and do this. And immediately there was a group of attorneys who filed a lawsuit. And so there's a stay. But if there is an end to birthright citizenship, right, if there is an attack on the 14th Amendment, and I mean, and again, like, that was Trump's number one out the gate, you know, executive order was to end birthright citizenship, right? So in a country where we're, where they're saying there's roughly 11 million, maybe 12 million undocumented people, imagine what happens when overnight being born in the United States does not automatically grant you citizenship. You are like, the floodgates will be open for who they can deem undocumented, right? So that's on the one hand. On the other, the legal strategies, as we know, have been piecemeal because the ground keeps shifting beneath people's feet, right? When you, you know, I think Adam's book really brings home the notion that there is no such thing really historically as due process for immigrants, for undocumented people. Right? Some get it, very small, slim margin. But now that the courts are even more impacted, now that you have the state detaining children, mm-hmm. right, who are being forced to see a judge with, you know, as young as 2 or 3 years old to sit in front of a judge. I mean, the strategy, again, it's really about nonprofit organizations, immigrants' rights organizations that are doing this kind of work nationally, but these people are exhausted because they have been dealing with this since 2016, right? Since 2017,
and before, when
Trump, and yeah. before, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, the only other thing I'd add is that, you know, sometimes there's a multi-pronged strategy that people rely on, and that's kind of one of the sword and the shield is sometimes the phrasing that's used. But, you know, legal strategies and turning to the courts is often much more of a defensive measure in response mm-hmm. to something.
Mm-hmm.
You know, movement building and pushing for legislative political change is where broader transformations could potentially happen. Mm-hmm. And I think obviously you need both. You need all of them. But it's, you know, with the legislative solutions, which aren't necessarily on the table now or anytime soon, but that's what would change something. I mean, this reality that we have, you know, what the historian May Nye calls the impossible subjects who live among us. You know, undocumented people who are both legal impossibilities in the eyes of the state, but also social realities that have lived here for years or decades. And until that is addressed through legislative reform, both to provide some path to regularize status of people in the country currently, as well as some provisions for people in the future who want to come. If there's one thing we know throughout history, it's that migration has continued.
Yeah.
People continue to migrate. You know, the questions are under what conditions and at what cost to them. But migration is the constant throughout history. And I think we're seeing this moment of extreme crackdown on immigration mm-hmm. to tremendous cost for mm-hmm. you know, children, mm-hmm. men, women, families, communities, et cetera, as we've been discussing here mm-hmm. today. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have to be that way. And you know, through legislative reform over time and through pressure to make that a possibility in the future, you know, mm-hmm. that could change.
Mm-hmm.
Not saying it's likely, but I think it's possible. I mean, I think, what other option is there?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's almost a fatalist perspective to say, like, this is never going to happen. Like, why even bother? Like, that's like a privileged perspective to have when people are literally fighting for their
mm-hmm,
lives
mm-hmm.
and the lives of their families.
Yeah.
And so, you know, what other option do we have?
Mm-hmm. And I'll, you know, we have to end soon because we've got to pick up the chairs and stuff and make sure all the tables get put away. But I just want to reinforce the organizations in Iowa City who are doing this work in Johnson County, and also a shout out to some of our elected officials who are doing beautiful work. John Green, V. Fixmar Rise, Mandy Remington, those are our supervisors. Oliver, who's doing work on city council. We need to support our local politicians who are very tuned in to making Johnson County a source for human rights in Iowa. As I said at the jump, we are a tiny sea of blue in an ocean of red. People will be looking to what we do to support the people in our communities. So we need to be that example, right? We need to show not just the rest of Iowa and the rest of the Midwest, but the rest of the country, that people in this city, in this county, care about their neighbors, care about the children that live in this community and the people that keep this community running. Right? We need to be that model. I know we can be. We have wonderful people, I know, in this very room who are willing to give of their time, right, and their effort and their hearts to this work, because it's going to get harder. Right? So we need to shore up the folks who are already doing this work and support the politicians and put pressure on the ones who are on the line and are scared to speak out. We need to say, hey, look, we'll support you, but you have to come out and defend the people at the very margins of our communities right now. If we believe in democracy, if we believe in things like due process, if we believe in the 14th Amendment, this is our work, right? This is our work right now. Thank you.
We hope to see you tomorrow, Saturday the 4th, at 4 p.m. in the Iowa City Ped Mall for our next program, a Togolese celebration in Iowa, and on Monday, 13 October, at 6 p.m. in the library for Indigenous Strength, Food Sovereignty, and Language Revitalization. If you were moved today by this free program, please consider making a donation on your way out. Also, please consider buying a book on your way out. And let's once again have a huge round of applause for this wonderful presentation.